All right, today I'm in Tewkesbury with racecourse bookmaker Paul Goad. Thank you very much for agreeing to talk to us today, Paul. Right, we'll get straight on to it. You're an on-course bookie. When was the last time you restricted somebody's bet?
If I do recall, it was quite recently. It's all about the cash. So that's the only... Clearly I will look down at the machine. If we've got 16 on the board and it's only 17 to a tenner sort of thing, and someone wants like 500 quid each way, I may make some comment, or I may blame someone for, we should only have 14 to one up. But at the last Ascot meeting a few Saturdays ago, we were running three pitches there, and it's a Dean Ivory horse. I think it was about the fifth race, and it was a stakes race, i.e. non-handicap, and this guy came up and wanted £500 each way, a horse at 16 to 1. So I said, no, you can have 300 each way. Why did I make the decision? Because of the cash. I didn't have the cash on me to pay him. But the follow-up to that is the other one of the other two pitches on the back line, where we had a member of staff working for us, and there's about three or four runners to go in the stalls, and I think it was a bit of a plot on the day. Another chap went up to him and had £500 each way, and the member of staff actually took the bet. So we were running around the ring trying to back this horse, and we stood it for a lot more than what we normally do these days. And the horse led. The jockey knew that the horse, I mustn't say it was trying, because you have to say that all horses are trying. But anyway, this jockey rode this horse for its life, and about one or two furlongs out, it faded away and it finished out of the frame. So we lived to fight another day. So I only knock punters back. I would never knock them back at festivals and things like that. But it's mainly what, putting it crudely, the cash I have in my pocket.
So you laid him 300 with the fractions?
No, he didn't. No, he didn't ask for the fraction, so he couldn't have been that clued up, could he? But no, we don't. I don't. You know, you've got to be careful of odds on chances. Eight runners, you know, thanks four on or something like that, and then a bookmaker or one of the members of the staff will send one of his reps over to have his 100 each way sort of thing, because he can earn out the place, and I might not be too happy about that, but I don't knock punters back now.
Right, going back to your roots, you made good business decisions, as far as my research tells me, when to get into and out of the betting shop business where you started. Was it perception and business acumen, a bit of luck, or a bit of both?
Luck. I was very lucky. I sort of set of circumstances. From my accent, most people would tell that I come from London, and my mother moved away from London. My father died when I was two, so she was by herself. And we moved from London down to a place called Nettlebed, which is near Henley-on-Thames. And I had this... not too special job really in London. Basically, I was just like a tea boy and a filing clerk for a stockbroker's. And I got fed up doing that. And I saw an advert for a trainee manager, a guy called Sam Cowan, who perhaps people will know of Lewis, his son. He's been on the race course, not there anymore. But anyway, so I went to work for Sam for three or four years, and I met a guy there called John Smart, who so at this time I would have been about early 20s. I joined Cowans when I was about 18 till about 21, 22, and so I met John Smart, who was the general manager there. Now, Sam was a difficult man to get on with, and he had a succession of general managers. He's a very successful bookmaker, but it was quite an acquired taste, if you like. So anyway, John, I got to know him for a couple of years while he was there. John could see the writing on the wall that he was going to get the heave-ho. And he asked me if I wanted to go into business with him. And so I supplied my knowledge, if you like, or my limited knowledge, as I found out in later years, to running the bedding shop. So we bought a bedding shop in Headington, which is near Oxford. He stumped up the money, got a second mortgage on his house, and off we went. So that was very lucky to meet him, and we got to a situation. We decided that at that time, we started in 71. I think we started either just before or just after decimalisation, which shows you how old I am. And Hills and Ladbrokes Corals didn't want to know about South Wales. There was never any money down there as far as they're concerned. So we John used to go down there and get new licenses, and we managed to be fairly successful, albeit with the help of the bank, and went from there. So we had those from about 71. I think we sold those shops in maybe 85, 86. So I think I was lucky to meet him. Good guy. You meet people in life that, I mean, we all have lots of acquaintances, but you know, people you can call really good friends, and he's still alive and a bit older than me, but a great guy.
Okay, so you did well with the betting shops. How many did you have?
We had about, I can't remember how many we had when we sold, but any one given time, we had about 20 odd betting shops. I think that, you know, we're doing it on a seat of our pants because we really didn't have a great deal of money, but we kept going, it worked out all right, you know. And he, as I said, just as I alluded to a little while ago, John was a bit older than me, and he'd had enough and wanted to sell, so we sold the shops, and eventually I went to live in Spain, and for about 7 or 8 years.
Okay, so you made a few quid in those betting shops. What were the sort of bets that punters had that had you rubbing your hands together?
Well, I can only speak of myself. We'll move on to it in a moment. But I sold the betting shops the second time round in 2003. I'm going back, you know, from memory. But we used to have the morning trade and the afternoon trade. I don't know what other bookmakers used to call it, but I used to call the morning trade. We used to take all these, what we call rubbish bets. So basically you could put them in a drawer and sell them at the end of the day. Obviously sometimes they'd cop. But the Yankees, the Lucky 15s, football betting wasn't very big. I'm just trying to think, get me some sort of order. I think that took off when I had the shops the second time around. But you weren't allowed to have singles on football coupons, so people would have accumulators. I think punters like the fact that they could, at that time, spend £1 and win thousands if they were successful, so they could actually do something with the money, as opposed to having like £1 on a 3-1 winner, you know, you wouldn't win very much. So the morning trade was very good. The afternoon trade, you know, it's just single, so the margin is less than, so obviously we used to do all sorts of things to encourage the morning trade.
So what were the sort of punters that you didn't really fancy?
Nothing much changes there. The guys that would have, I think at that time, my memory serves me right, we had betting duty. And so from time to time, we would monitor customers who were having £400 or £500 on, two on chances in a cricket match or tennis or, you know, match bets or some, and we would monitor those. So, I mean, if they were, they may lose a bit on their turnover, but if the time we then knocked off the betting tax, they were uneconomical. I don't recall really knocking anyone, I don't recall ever knocking anyone back, but I do recall monitoring customers. Not many.
Okay, so you did well with the betting shots. What prompted you to make the decision to invest into the on-course game?
Well, when I came back from living in Spain, I'm a great believer in sticking to what you know. I have tried other ventures, and what perhaps in my sort of limited way has been successful. So when I was living in Spain, I Corals put an advertisement in the at that time, I think it was the Sporting Life, about they want they were selling shops. They wanted to upgrade their estate. I think they were called the Blue Shops. So I bought some shops from Corals in about early 90s and no late 80s, sorry, and I ran those for a while, but with the advent of Sunday racing and evening racing and that sort of thing and the staffing, and I'd always had an inkling to always fancied working at the race course. And so in about, I think when the buying and selling of pitches first came out in 99, I bought some pitches from a guy called Frank Butler, I think his name was, Cheltenham, Chepstow, Worcester, Stratford. And I'd run those in conjunction with running the betting shops. And I was far more interested really in going to like Chepstow on a Thursday than I was in running the betting shops. And so I just always fancied it. It's obviously not, even though I had the background of being in betting shops and knowing a bit about gambling, it's not a question of just filling the hod up at the race course. So that's how I got into the race course game. It's something I fancied doing, and an opportunity arose with the buying and selling of pitches.
So how did running the betting shop empire compare to running the on-course business?
Well, the first thing to say is there's less staff, many, many less staff. I think it's a bit of an eye-opener when... what does it do with the betting shops? The thing with the betting shops is that when you employ a significant sort of number of people, you spend a disproportionate amount of time dealing with the, say you employed 100 staff, dealing with the 10 that are always ill or moaning and of course, don't start me on about fiddles. I mainly employ now my daughters and my wife at the race course, and of course I suppose we'll move on to that in a moment. I'm with Paul Metcalf now, and Ian's our mainstay. But the off course market, I just got fed up doing it. I got fed up with the old social hours. I got fed up working on a Sunday afternoon because we were short of staff. The summer holidays are a nightmare. But I'm not forgetting the relatively small success that I have, it just came from the money of the betting shop.
Okay, Paul, well, I know just from working on the floor in Clarkin that the on-course business can be extremely precarious, especially for somebody that's a bit green. Did you test the water before investing?
Yes, I did, because when I had the betting shops first time round, I used to go racing maybe once a week. I got to know you know, different characters there. The Tic Tacs, at that time, it was a guy called Mickey Fingers, Mickey Oki. You got to know the punters. I think Stan Flashman, I think. There was a guy. And then I got to know, only in a very small way, John Banks, Jeff's father. But anyway, how did I test the water? I don't know how we got to know him, but I met a guy who I think his name was Fred Stevens, and he used to bet in the Silver Ring. Some good pitches in the Silver Ring. And so I went, and it would be Plumpton and Fontwall, the sort of southern tracks. And the only problem with Fred was he thought he was a bit of a judge. And as soon as this sounds silly thing to say now, because we all do it now, but as soon as the result was known, he'd put the prices up for the next race. He'd do his own tissue, and there were people there cleverer than him who would come and have other bets. I think Dave Sapphire used to do his own tissue and his stuff. And, you know, I would say to Fred, hold on, Fred, after about a third race, I want to go to a toilet, okay, or do something. Don't put any prices up. And I'd come back and he'd have queues. And this was our sort of money. And the other, how I also tested the water is we had this... you know, as I said earlier, you get to know workmen. As it sounds a bit derogatory calling them workmen, but floor men, if you like, at the races. And there was one guy there that said to me, and this is, you know, how gullible can you be? Oh, my boss is looking for someone to help him out of the White City Dogs in the cheap ring. And so obviously he's going back, you know, when White City was open. So I thought, well, I'm game for that. Much to my wife's annoyance of going every Saturday night. Anyway, we used to go over there, and I used to go over there, and all the bets went in pencil, and doesn't matter what seemed to win, we never seemed to do very well. And so I'm sure it was a run of just bad results, but I lasted about 6 weeks of that. So I tested the water in that respect, That was my market research, if you like.
So when you actually invested your own money and bought your own pitches, betting as Pickwick, how did the on-course business meet your expectations?
Yes, I was very enthusiastic. I'm still enthusiastic now. As I said, I bought from... I ran them in conjunction. So I bought Cheltenham... Worcester, Stratford and Chepstow. And I used to get like so despondent if Chepstow was off. But I mean, the game has changed immeasurably since 99, you know, with printed receipts and all this sort of thing. So it did meet my expectations, yes, very much so.
Okay, you're one of the few that bought in early and are still here to tell the tale. What was the biggest mistake that those that did their cobblers in double quick time make as bookmakers?
I think I had half a chance because of the betting shops. So I knew a few of the cons, if you like, or what to be wary of. And I mean, it's portrayed on television that you feel the hod up. Sorry, that's the bag where you put the cash. And the results take care of themselves. I think the results do take care of themselves over a period of time if you've got the right margin on the board. But to just go in there and take on the world, a lot of bookmakers have been like punters. I mean, in the 20 years or so I've been at the races, you'll see people turn up with load of money and think they know what they're doing, and then over a period of about a year they slowly do it all in. So I've always been an enthusiastic on-course bookmaker. As I've got older, what I don't like, I guess what a lot of older people would say, is the driving.
Okay, so how are things on course at the moment?
My standard answer to that is that the midweek racing is a bit of a struggle. Fridays, Saturdays usually okay. And the festival's all right. But we keep going. The race courses have done a few incentives. I think the profile of the punter has changed. You know, you get a lot of groups of young ladies, young guys, hen do's, stag do's coming along to the races and enjoying themselves. And it's just part of what they do, their entertainment for the day. Apart from the festivals and major events like the Champions Day and things like that, the larger punters you don't see too many of now.
So have bookmakers had to reset their expectations a little bit?
Yeah, I think so. I saw some photographs the other day on Twitter of I think in Maury Peters or someone like that of some years ago now, where I think his minimum bet was a fiver. Well, on a quiet day at, I better be careful what I say, it's a quiet day at Wincanton, if someone wants a pound each way, we'll take it. You know, it's, you just have to take what's there, really.
Okay, there's people that now like to say that on-course bookmakers, just commission agents, have everything back and green up every race. How realistic is that assumption?
Well, I don't go around really looking at people's books, so I don't know that many people who actually green up. I know one or two, but we will stand horses, not for a lot of money, I would hasten to add. Although, at the early part of the interview, this thing at Ascot a few weeks ago, we had to stand a horse for more than what we normally do. I guess, 5 or 6, there was a good period of time where I would stand horses for myself, what I would consider quite a lot of money. Now, I've been in the bookmaking game like for about 50 years, and I've never got used to losing. I take it that you've got to lose, and I pay with a smile. So in the early days, I would go to, let's say, somewhere like Taunton, and I would win like £4,000. Everything was rosy, great drive back. I'd then go to Chepstow the next day and do £3,000. And so, you know, after X's, there wouldn't be a lot in it. And it's just too much of an emotional roller coaster. So we play fairly tight. We don't green up now. And I don't actually, I think I know one or two who do, but I think the expenses are so high that you know, we are bookmakers after all.
Okay, so how many meetings that you could go to would you miss these days?
I don't think we actually miss any meetings because I still enjoy going. We only miss because of obviously cancellations or a clash. Sometimes this last season, Salisbury would clash with Ascot on a Saturday like King George Day, so we'd give Salisbury a miss. We'd make a decision based on... where we thought we could take where our turnover would be the greatest.
Okay, when the buying and selling came in, a lot of places were filled up all the time. And do you think the racecourses have found their level now?
Well, I think I'd have to say no, because there are still quite a few bookmakers who go who haven't got very good pitches. Now I've been fortunate in that. I guess because of the betting shops and the way my life has evolved, I've managed to buy some decent pitches. What I would like to say, Simon, is that I think you betting shops. The one big similarity between betting shops and the on-course market is this much used phrase of location. So in the betting shops, I always wanted them in a high street. A lot of pedestrian footfall, and also at the race course. You want to be somewhere where the punters are going to come through to you from the bar. There are some bookmakers who still go now are from poor numbers, and I just don't know how they make it pay. But the number that attend has reduced slightly, I think, over the recent years.
Okay, what would your advice be to a young person who wishes to become a bookie, a racecourse bookie?
Yeah, I would. What I would do is, if you're starting from the basis of not knowing anybody or not having any experience, I would go to work for a bookmaker and learn the trade. I think you've got to learn to know what's going on, and it's not just a question of taking all the bets, because you know, anyone could put up 9 to 4 and everyone else is 2 to 1, then obviously you'll take a lot of money on it, and over a period of time you do your money. So I would work for a bookmaker and get the experience, is first of all. I would then look at the calendar, and I'd buy pitches on a Saturday, because it's the best day of the week, when there were quite a few clashes. As I said to you earlier on, for example, Ascot clashes with Salisbury. So what you'll find is most bookmakers would go to Ascot to reduce the numbers at Salisbury. So even relatively a high number pitch, as in like sort of 25, 26 or something like that at Salisbury, you may get quite a move up because most of the bookmakers would be at Ascot. So I would go to the races. I'd get myself a job if I could. And take it from there.
Okay, what qualities do you think you would need to become a good bookmaker?
Patience. Patience and not get despondent. If you've got it, if you think you've got it right, I mean, there's many ways of skinning a cat. You know, you can stand the outsiders, have the favourites running for you, vice versa. I always like to, well, I don't like, but I always like to have the favourites as a loser. And, but just not get too depressed about it. It's like a marathon. It's not a sprint, you know. I mean, every day is another day. You know, you can win and lose. So just be patient and don't get too upset about it.
Okay, so alternatively, what are the characteristics of a bad, destined to be unsuccessful bookmaker?
Well, as I said earlier on, you know, going over the odds, thinking you could take on the world, it's life is easy. It isn't easy. You know, also you've got the expenses of employing people at the racecourse badges. And I think, as I say, I have never, ever got used to losing. But certainly customers would not... I would always pie them out with a smile. You've got to learn the trade by working for someone and pay out with a smile. I don't know, perhaps we'll talk about it later on. I mean, I had the betting shops when Dettori won, and you know, I paid the customers what they won, and it was through gritted teeth, if you like, but I smiled. They didn't know how I felt inside, if you like. But
how long did it take to get it back off them?
Off of one of them, I don't think I ever did. We had two people, one in Cardiff and one in, well, funny enough, in Tewkesbury, who both had pound each way accumulators, and at the morning prices. And the first one, a guy called Richard in Tewkesbury, he really got the bit between his teeth. They both won £100,000. It was my limit at the time. He really got the bit between his teeth. So he used to back Dettori's horses blindly prior to his Magnificent Seven. And he just upped his stake. And it took me about 2 years or so to get the money back off of him. The other guy just carried on his small bets.
Okay, Paul, we can't leave it there, because you said that you got £100,000 back off a lucky punter that had a pound each way accumulator in 2 years. What did you do? Send a car around for him?
Yeah, I shouldn't have done. It might have been 3 years. Okay, but I mean, this is like when it was it 90? When did he? When did, I can't remember when he wrote
96, wasn't it?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I used to dread the anniversary every year when it came around because we always seemed to have seven rides because the punters would back all these accumulative bets. But there was a couple of interesting anecdotes about this Dettori. So this guy, Richard, had this singles and doubles and things. Anyway, the main damage was the accumulator at the morning prices. And I can't remember when, but maybe after three or four races, I hedged, I had an accumulator myself then, well, obviously for the firm, with Hills. And so that was all taken care of and I could sort of relax a bit. And then we had this shop in Cardiff and the guy rung up and he gave me some sort of like bet that was going to come to, I don't know, 800 or 900 quid. And so he said, oh, by the way, while I'm on, I better give you this, was it Heinz is six? I think either called Super Heinz or Goliaths, I can't remember now. It was seven selections.
Super Heinz.
Super Heinz. So he had done Dettori's mounts for 10p, which sounds peanuts now, but the killer was he had a pound each way accumulated on the bottom, and this guy told me after about three or four races. And so, because I wasn't very happy about that, in fact, I think afterwards he said to me, don't you ever talk to me like that again. And I sort of obviously gave him a few choice words. But the anecdote was that, so I was clearly in trouble with this bet, and I couldn't really get on with anybody, you know, obviously all the prices contracted. And in a... I'm not sure if in his interview that you did recently with Stephen Little, if I had any bets that were going to come to a few quid, I used to ring him up when he was at a course and have a bet with him, you know, a singles. Anyway, I had a £10,000 double, Dettori's last two mounts. And watching the races, it always seemed to me, I'm a great believer in fate, it was going to happen. You could see the favourite would get in trouble if he wasn't on the favourite or something else. Anyway, he weaved his way round, as everyone knows, the last 2-1. I shan't make any comment about the last race, which I don't want to get myself into trouble with all the other jockeys. But there we go. So anyway, I rang Stephen Little up at about 6:30 on the Saturday and I said, hi Stephen, I just wanted to confirm a figure. And I'd won 54,000 off of him. And I said, oh, I just want to confirm the figure of this £10,000 double. And Stephen used to write his bets down. He used to have a piece of card around his arm. And he used to write all these bets down on this card, sort of elastic, it's all a bit basic. And he said, £10,000 double? Oh, I don't know anything about that. So that was like a sleepless night. So he said, ring me back in the morning. So anyway, I rang him back in the morning and he'd written it in the corner, you know, Pickwick's £10,000 double. And give Stephen his credit, I think by the Tuesday, after the happening on Saturday, I had my money. Anyway, I backed with this accumulator with Hills and I'd won about 140 grand. And I needed, obviously, the money to pay the customers. And so I, it was probably about 130,000 because we lost a bit on the bets. But so I rang Hills and Hills used to settle their accounts alphabetically, one half of the alphabet one week, the other half the following week. And so Pickwick, when I rang up, we were in the second week. And then when I asked for sort of special dispensation to get my money so I could pay the punter, the signatories, because it was such a large amount of money, one of them was sick, they needed two signatures on the checks. But eventually I got my money. And all I would say finally about the Dettori thing was that at that time, I think it was when scratch cards came out, it gave us a big boost, bookmakers in general, because it proved that we could pay and people could win a lot of money. And it was very good for the business, I think.
Right, moving on now to the present day. You're now in a partnership with one of the oldest bookmaking firms in the country, On Course, Jack Bevan and Co, established 1897. How did that come about?
Well, that came about because I got to, well, I knew his dad, I knew Ian, Paul's dad, And so we used to talk, as you do at the races, you know, and we, you know, whilst I said, I don't go around, I'm not one of these bookies, goes around at different people's books, see what, when they're off and see what's on. But I would talk to him about it, you know, have a look at his computer, he'd come and look at mine, that sort of thing. And we would have the same sort of view, you know, we'd want the favourites to be a loser, second in, pretty straight across if you like, and the rest winners. And so with the expenses of the midweek racing, we decided to go into partnership. So we've been doing that for four, I can't remember, time goes past, I guess, when you're enjoying yourself, for about the last 4 or 5 years. And he has this, whilst I said earlier on, my daughters work for us a lot of the time, Ian, who's the mainstay of Jack Bevan, has been with them for years and years and years. He is the main person. So we were able to cut down on a number of staff, and we have this partnership, which from my point of view I'm very pleased with.
Okay, so you work with your wife and family as well on your part of the business. How do you separate from the working day when you're having a bad run?
Well, because we don't stand the horses for a fortune, I think I've got more mature, I suppose, is the answer to that. As you get older, you take it on the chin. I try not to be too much of a mood. I don't think the girls, my daughters, know about how we're done, but I think my wife will take perhaps will disagree. She will always say when I come through the door, but because I don't have these winning $4,000, doing $3,000 days, I just sort of accept it more now.
Okay, what's the most frustrating thing about being a racecourse bookie?
Most frustrating thing? I get a bit irritated with the guys on the gate because we're supposed to be able to drive in 2 hours before and you get there 2 and a quarter hours and they won't let you in. Most frustrating thing? Apart from that, I don't know. It'll be trivial things like food. You know, the food can be disappointing. Some racecourses, are very good. I mean, I don't bet a Newton Abbott anymore, but the menu there was always very good.
Okay, so do you get many disputes?
The only occasionally. For those that don't know, if you can't resolve it yourself, you refer to the betting ring manager. But since the buying and selling came in, maybe about 99 or 2000, we give printed receipts now, so that has cut down on disputes immeasurably. We get lost tickets; they have to fill in a lost ticket claim form. But by and large, we don't get too many disputes.
Okay, so do any of your customers still get credit?
Definitely not.
So they don't knock you anymore, is that why they don't get credit?
That's right, yeah. I had enough of that when I had the betting shops and had a credit business.
So what's the biggest problem that the betting ring faces at the moment, or do you think it's quite in rude health?
There's a danger of us all talking it down. As I said earlier, I think the Fridays, Saturdays, Sundays is more of a family day. The festivals, you know, the Easter Mondays, they're still good. During the week, I think, well, I've gone in with Paul Metcalf. We've got this partnership, which has cut down on our costs. I think that during the week, it is more of a struggle. As I said earlier on, I can't really understand how so many people survive. Because, you know, the cost of the badge goes up every year and it can be quite expensive.
Okay, so what would you like to see done to help racecourse bookies?
We've all signed up these contracts of tenure that we have now with the racecourse. I think perhaps what wasn't envisaged was the cost of the badge when, for example, it's a concert there, and the profile of the customer. I mean, I've got nothing against them. I don't really know anything about them. But say, for example, if Little Mix is going to be the headline act, then you're going to get a lot of young people there who are not going to be punters. I think that and our badge fee is a multiple 6 or 7 times the entrance fee. So if the customer is paying 40 quid, which is unbelievable value, if you get sort of you get pop entertainment, a group, you've got, say, a Newbury, you get 6 or 7 good class races for like 40 quid. But the trouble is, our badge will be £280, then we could pay for the staff to get in. So I think perhaps that could be addressed as to, reducing that we don't actually on those days pay. There ought to be a ceiling on what the maximum our badge can be.
Okay, and what can bookies do to help themselves?
Stop moaning.
And moving on into the future, what can they do to bring the betting ring up to date?
I think you could continue to innovate. So I'm not putting ourselves up as like a trailblazer. But for example, Paul's much younger than me. We now do contactless payments. I got a bit sort of fed up with customers saying to me, can you tell me where the nearest cash point is? And even in your like social life, away from the race course, you go and have a coffee, everyone pays on their phone. So we offer contactless payments now, which seems particularly at the busier meetings, very successful.
Okay, so sell it to me.
Technology is the future.
Okay, so a lot of punters moaning online, they can't get on, they get their bets cut back. So why should punters that struggle to get on online start making their way back to the race course? Sell it to us.
I don't think they would get knocked back at all. Okay, you can quite often back a horse that is the, everyone knows that on our laptops we have Betfair or BetDAC, that is sometimes our price is bigger than the price which is available on the exchange because we want to lay it, not for any dubious reasons, just for that, for example, I'll want to get the favourite in, and if I have to go 9 to 4 and it's only 2 to 1 available, so be it. So I think there's tremendous value. It's very competitive and tremendous value. So the punter should come and give it a go.
Okay, finally, Paul, how do you see the future of the betting ring? Are you an optimist?
Well, I'm a bookmaker, so I'm always an optimist, rather. Yes, I'm optimistic about the future. I'd like to see more younger people coming into the game. As I said earlier on learning the trade. But yes, I am an optimist about the future. I think more and more of us would do things like contactless payments, which encourages young people. I think we've got to try and not be so, people come up very shy and coy and don't, sort of excuse me, as though that they're doing us a favour having a bet. You've just got to make them feel more relaxed and be friendly and pay out with a smile.
Brilliant. All good.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Simon, for interviewing me.
New Betting People interviews are published every week at Star Sports. Exclusive interviews with the key people from the world of sports betting. Check out our full library of interviews at starsportsbet.co.uk, begambleaware.org. Over 18 only.